Father, we thank you for your goodness and your grace. We thank you for your word. We thank you that you have kept your revelation preserved and available to us so that we can read and understand your plans and purposes for us and for the whole world, so that we don't have to wander around wondering what in the world is going on, but we actually know that everything is unfolding under your sovereign, merciful, gracious care. And so, Lord, we pray that the things we read and study will be an encouragement to us. And above all things, it'll help us to love you with a sincere heart and a clear conscience and a sincere faith. And so we ask all these things for Jesus' great name's sake. Amen. All right, y'all. Chapter 13 in 2 Samuel, page 63 in your notes. Like I said last week, y'all, buckle up. Here we go. We're into the Mississippi, Alabama soap opera drama here. It gets bad for the next several chapters, without a doubt. There was a note that I put, let me see where this is. Yeah, there's a couple of notes. There's one on page 61 that last week we talked about, where Nathan confronts David about his sin with Bathsheba. And there, that note, you don't have to turn there to read it, but when Nathan confronts David about his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah, it sets in motion everything that happens from that point forward. And we're going to look at some of this today. We're going to look back to some of the things that Nathan said with the chapters that we're going to get into. So this whole section that we're in is really, in a sense, the fulfillment of what the Lord had spoken against David when Nathan confronted him. Well, let's just read that. Turn over to let's do that. Turn over to chapter 12. Chapter 12 in 2 Samuel. Yeah, let's read this, because as we then go through these following chapters, you'll be able to see how the Lord does the very thing that he's talking about. So, chapter 12, Nathan is sent to rebuke David for his sinfulness. He tells him the story of the man had a precious ewe lamb. Y'all remember that story? David gets enraged and he says, that man needs to pay back fourfold what he did because of this thing. He had no pity. And so he also says, that man deserves to die. And of course, Nathan says, you are the man, David. You've done that, in what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah. But then in verse 9, after the Lord tells him exactly what he's done, the main thing is, he says, why have you despised the word of the Lord Yahweh to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. This is the Lord speaking to David through Nathan. And then he gives him the consequences of his sin. Verse 10, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. The sword is, in other words, there's always going to be violence in David's house. And if you've read the rest of the story in Kings and Chronicles, that's exactly what happens. Murder, intrigue. We're about to get into some of it today with Amnon and Tamar and Absalom. That's absolutely going to happen. And it happens all the way to the end. Verse 11, the Lord goes on to say, thus says the Lord Yahweh, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house. And I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. Now, if you've read ahead to the Absalom story, it's exactly what Absalom is going to do. 12, for you did this thing secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the son. So in other words, this is going to be a national episode of intrigue that the Lord is going to bring on David. And boy, he brings it swift, too. Verse 13, but then we said, this is the real powerful part of this. David said to Nathan, I've sinned against the Lord Yahweh. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. David is twice worthy of death. I was thinking about this last week. I can't remember if I said this. In all of Saul's treachery, I don't think, even though he neglected the words of the Lord, right? He neglected the commands of the Lord. There is nothing that he did that reaches the level of sin that David does right here in this one chapter. The adultery and the murder, right? And just because Saul had done the same thing, right? He had despised the word of the Lord, right? David is doing the same thing, but he's doing it in a more heinous way. That's all I ever thought about doing, right? Saul is cut off from being king. And what does the Lord do for David? We talked about this last week. He put his sin away from him, right? Incredible statement about the Lord's mercy. And of course, this is what David meditates on in many of the Psalms. So as we get into these next chapters, it's clear two things are happening. Number one, the Lord still shows his favor to David in the midst of all this chaos that's going to happen. He still works on David. He's still on David's side. He brings relief and safety to David, whereas he turns everything inside out with the rest of his family, who turns against David in these chapters. So very, very dark section of this whole story. And in fact, this family drama is going to take us all the way to the end of Samuel. And so we're going to be in the soap opera for the next several chapters. Y'all just get ready. The other thing that's really significant is, let's see, where is that? I'm just telling you where this is. You can go back and look at it. I can't see it. This whole section is in a sense a prefiguring, a mirroring of what happens with David. Oh, it's on page 59 in your notes. The very top, David's great sin, birth of Solomon, right under that. This whole episode also prefigures what's going to happen with the nation of Israel. David is going to be displaced as king. He's going to seek exile in the east, in the capital of one of his enemies. But then at the end of that, he's going to be returned to rebuild his kingdom and reestablish his kingdom. If you remember, that's exactly what happens to the nation of Israel. They are exiled to the east in Babylon. And after a time of exile there, they are sent back to the land to begin the long, multi-year task of rebuilding the whole nation and the kingdom and everything else. So this story of David is meant to be a prefiguring of what happens to the nation of Israel. And to me, that is really significant because if I'm right, and these books finally came together in their final form as we have them during the time of the exile, right, when Israel is in captivity in Babylon, then these stories are meant to be an encouragement to them in the sense of, now, wait a minute, David, the Lord has made promises to David, right? He's made sure promises to David that one of his sons is going to dwell on his throne, that his kingdom will never end, that David will never lack having a man to sit on the throne over Israel. So if he's made those promises, the Lord has to be faithful to keep them. And if the Lord could send David into exile and bring him back to restore his kingdom, then he can do the same thing for us, right? Because the Lord does these patterns, right? You remember Ecclesiastes? Whatever the Lord has done in the past, he'll seek to do those same things again, right? He works in those patterns. So these books are meant to be an encouragement in my mind to the people of Israel in exile, that the Lord has not completely cut them off, that he's made these promises, and the only way he can fulfill them is by restoring us to our land in the same way he did David, in the same way he did in Israel of the past, after they had been exiled in Egypt for all the time. He brought them back and restored them, right? So these books are meant to be a real encouragement, it seems like. And these books are meant to tell us there's nothing new under the sun, right? People are still as wicked and twisted back then as they are today, as they will be in the future, right? With all the technological changes that have happened in the millennia, in the history of planet Earth, the only thing that has not changed is human nature, right? We're still the same. And we read these stories and we see I mean, these could be headlines today, in a sense, you know, the things that we're about to look into and look into read. So with all that in mind, page 63 in your notes, chapters 13 and 14, you get the Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom story. And this is a critical turning point. I'm not going to read all this. We're just going to look at some of the high points. There's nothing in this that you can't read in the English text and pick up exactly what's going on there. But I want to highlight some of the things that are said. So let's start. Chapter 13, verse 1. It said, now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister. Absalom had only been mentioned briefly earlier. Now he enters the story. And so we're going to find out who he is and what he's up to. Also, we're going to find out about Amnon, Tamar. This is the first time they really enter into the story. So Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. We're going to see a lot of crafty people. If you remember, this is the very thing that Saul had charged against David when he was trying to hunt him down in the wilderness. He says, he is very crafty, right? So he said to him, oh, son of the king, why are you so haggard this morning? So basically, Jonadab comes up with a scheme to call for Tamar to come in and, you know, pretend he's sick and come in and she'll take care of you. And then when she comes in, you can, you know, take her in private and do whatever is in your mind to do whatever you want to do. So that's what happens. And as y'all know, she comes in. And he rapes Tamar, right, against her will. She even pleads with him. Listen, don't do this terrible thing. Look at verse 12. Verse 12, she says, she answered Amnon, no, my brother, do not violate me. The word in Hebrew is humiliate me. But violate's a good term. I think humiliate's a little bit better, because if he does this, it's going to humiliate her in private, in public. You know, it's going to be disastrous, especially for her. She says, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the outrageous fools in Israel. This calls back to the story of Nabal. You remember the wife of Abigail? Thank you. Brain jumping on me. Nabal, whose name literally means fool. Remember how foolish he was. So here Amnon is put up to be one of the outrageous fools. You know, he's doing things that's just only the extremely foolish would think to do something like this. She says, now therefore speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. But he would not listen to her. And being stronger than he violated her and he lay with her. And then look at verse 15. And then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, get up and go. This is such a classic description of lust and addiction, right? Because here, if I could say it this way, Amnon has become addicted to the thought of Tamar. But then when he gets the very thing that he thinks he wants, he finds out, well, it didn't satisfy the way I thought it did. So then you hate the very thing that you've lusted after, right? Very common for that kind of thing to happen. Now, if you look on page 63, I've got a chart, because it's hard to keep track of who's who in this whole thing. So Amnon and Tamar at the top there. The first note, the first bullet point at the top there, Amnon was David's firstborn in Hebron. You can see this in 2 Samuel 3:2. And let me just go ahead and say, although I think I've got a note about this a little bit later, Amnon was the firstborn. Then there was another son who was secondborn, and that would have been, I think that was, no, that's not right. He's not on this chart. But he winds up dying early on. And then Absalom is the thirdborn. So technically, right here, you have heir number one and heir number two to the Davidic throne. Amnon is first in line, and Absalom is third in line because the second born son has died. So that puts that moves Absalom up the ladder, and he's second now. So this whole thing is between the heir apparent to David's throne and the next one in line. You understand? You follow me, right? That's why this story is so disastrous. The word Amnon in Hebrew means faithful. Isn't that interesting? The word Tamar is palm tree. date palm could also be translated. There's several women's names that are named after trees or plants, because in that area, trees were thought to be very beautiful. You know, they had a different sense of beauty than we do. You know, if you read the Song of Solomon, right, the Song of Songs, his primary idea of beauty is that her eyes point in the same direction and she's got all of her teeth, right? That's high standard of beauty. different than the way we think of things. But anyway, you get the idea. And it says that she was beautiful. That's emphasized in a couple of the other parallel stories. Absalom, you can actually see this in his name. It means father of peace. The A-B, Av, in Hebrew, pronounced with a V instead of a B. Av means father. Salam at the end of that is the root that we get shalom from. Jerusalem, that's also the word for peace, the city of peace, right? So Absalom's name means father of peace. And it's very interesting. The only name that aptly fits this whole story is Tamar's, right? Amnon is not going to be faithful, and Absalom is going to do anything but bring the peace of his father, right? He's going to bring nothing but turmoil, right? So really, really interesting. Now, on the chart, if you look down, you can see the relationship between all this. You see David up at the top, and all the men, if y'all look at that chart, right, and you see all those wives underneath there and the 10 concubines and all those kids, you're thinking, there's no way any one man can manage all of that, right? And all the women are thinking, who in the world would want to be part of that mess, right? So you see his wives, Michal the first, Abigail, Ahinoam, Makah.
Wasn't that to get certain areas?
Yes. Yeah, that was to consolidate political control and all that kind of stuff. But if you look there on the left-hand side, you have Amnon down toward the bottom. And his mother is Ahinoam. And then right next to that, you've got David's wife, Makah. And from her is Tamar and Absalom. So Absalom and Tamar, they are, you know, pure brother and sister, right? Same mother, same father. But Amnon is the half-brother of Tamar. Same father, different mother, right? So you can see the problem there. The Torah specifically forbids sexual relations with that close of relatives, right? So that's why what Amnon's trying to do here, it's not only heinous in and of itself because of the rape of it, but also it's in direct contradiction to the Torah. And that's why she says, "This, you're going to act like an outrageous fool in doing this thing. This is unheard of in Israel, what you're trying to do here." So you can see the treachery of it. That's where Absalom comes in, right? He is Tamar's actual brother, her full brother. And so after this, he's going to take Tamar in and function somewhat like a kinsman redeemer for her. And we'll see that in these next couple of chapters. In the bullet points under that on page 63, Amnon's lust and treachery is parallel to that of Shechem, the Canaanite who raped Dinah all the way back in Genesis 34. If you go back and you read that episode, there are things that are very similar there to this episode here. So you can go back and take a look at that. That led to all kind of family problems at the time of Jacob and the 12 sons and so forth. Again, bottom page 63, this kind of sexual relationship strictly forbidden under the Torah. just a really, I didn't know if I was going to put this in or not, but I thought, that's kind of an interesting statement. In 13, 6, 8, and 10, when Tamar comes in, she brings cakes to Amnon, and he's going to eat the cakes that she brings in. In a lot of translations, it's translated special cakes, special bread, something. But in Hebrew, the core of that word is the word for heart. And so scholars are divided. Does that mean she brings in heart-shaped cakes, or are they hearty cakes, right? Which, they don't know why they say they're heart-shaped, why the word heart is in the middle of that. I have a hard time thinking that they're heart-shaped cakes, because that's not something that the ancients associated in any kind of way with romantic love, or that's what some scholars want to say there in that. But, you know, heart-shaped stuff didn't come in until late 1800s, you know, so that doesn't make any sense. My thing is, I don't think we know what they're talking about there, why that is in the middle of it. I think probably the idea is closer to the idea of they were hearty cakes. In other words, these are things that, and even some scholars have thought these may have medicinal things in them, right? So these are cakes that would revive you, be helpful for somebody who's sick, medicinal, right? And of course, in Hebrew thought, the heart is the very core of your body, right? Or not body, but your core of your existence. Proverbs, above all else, guard your heart, for from it flow the springs of life, right? Everything flows out of the heart. So it seems to me that's probably what's going on. She's bringing something because he said he's sick, and she's bringing something to help him. Anyway, this is an interesting sideline note. So you read on. Amnon puts Tamar out, right? And she's begging him, and he calls his servant in and tells her to go out, right? Throw her out. And she goes out, and she mourns. With great mourning, right? She puts ashes on her head, tears her long robe, verse 19. But then verse 20, if you look down there, it says, now her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." So Tamar lived a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house, right? This episode completely wrecks her, as you would imagine. 21. Now, when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. Now, as y'all know, he doesn't say anything good or bad to Amnon because y'all know what he's thinking. I'm going to get him. Right? So I'm not going to give anything away yet. I'm going to get him. I guarantee. Right? David, though, he becomes enraged over what's happened here. But the bottom of page 63, we've got a big problem here. And it's simply this. There is very little David could do at this point due to the heinous nature of Amnon's crime. Right? And this is what's going on. The Torah required that a man who had sex with a virgin not pledged to another was obligated to marry her and pay a penalty. Right? But forcing Amnon to marry Tamar in fulfillment of Torah would also violate the instructions related to marrying close kin. Right? So this creates a no-win situation. Right? The payment that would be required would be 50 pieces of silver to the father, David, but that would be meaningless in this context because they're both his kids. Right? And what's 50 pieces of silver going to matter to David? Right? So this whole episode winds up making David look weak, just like Eli dealing with his wickedly foolish sons in the early chapters of Samuel. Remember that? Where Samuel's sons had, Eli's sons had rejected the word of the Lord, and they were doing all kind of terrible things, taking bribes. But Eli was, he was just weak in the way he handled them. So this whole episode makes David look weak. And especially with what's about to happen with his family, it's going to double up on making him look like a incompetent father and also an incompetent ruler, an incompetent king. And it all comes from his very family. Right? Remember what we just read the Lord said? I'll raise up people against you, even in your own household. So here, this comes to pass in a very, very powerful way. Now, any questions or comments on that section there? Everybody tracking along okay? Everybody doing all right? All righty. Verse 23, Amnon and Absalom, they're going to get together, and Absalom's going to work out a little plan here. So verse 23, after two full years, Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hatzor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons, right? So here, just to summarize what happens, Absalom throws this big party, for lack of a better word, and he invites all the king's sons, all of his extended family down, even David. And David says, "Man, we're going to be too much for you to handle. I'm not going to come down. Don't have us all come down." So Absalom pleads with him. "Well, listen, if y'all all can't come down, make sure my brother Amnon comes down. I really want him to come on down here." So they send Amnon down along with some of the other king's sons. And verse 28, it said, Absalom commanded his servants, "Mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." That's some of the same words that Joshua says to the army at the time of the conquest, right? It's some of the same words that Saul said to his army when they were fighting the Philistines. It's some of the same words that David had said to his men when they're fighting their battles and whatnot. And here, Absalom says it to his servants in relation to murdering his half-brother. So you get the irony in that, right? 29, so the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom commanded. And then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. That's, look at that. Their mule, right? Wow. Shouldn't they be riding a big war horse or, you know, something like that? No? Mule is what you rode back then. So here they all, Absalom kills Amnon, and it's really interesting. Note on page 64 there, this is almost the same thing that Amnon had done with Tamar. He uses his father's influence to lure Amnon into his trap, and then when he gets there, instead of doing something else, he kills Amnon. So here we see Absalom, as I say, has inherited his craftiness, shrewdness, cunning, as Saul had said about his father before him. In fact, we're going to see all of David's sons are very crafty, right? Very cunning in the things that they do. So Absalom kills Amnon, and the sons go back to David in Jerusalem. And as they're making their way back, a servant comes. Or news came to David that all of his sons had been killed by Absalom. So you can imagine, he tears his garments, he lays on the earth. But then another messenger comes in and says, "Listen, no, not everybody's been killed. Only Amnon was murdered or killed by Absalom." And he tells him, Absalom had that in his mind from the day that Amnon had raped Tamar. So, you know, this is a bad deal, but that's where it all came out of. So don't take too much grief. Verse 34, Absalom, he flees to Geshur, to Talmi, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. I've got a note about this on page 64. That is Absalom's grandfather on his mother's side. So Absalom murders Amnon, and then he flees down to his grandfather in Geshur. And so he's going to remain there for some time, and David is not going to call him back, although he mourns over his son, right? He mourns over Absalom being in exile in Geshur. And verse 38, it tells us he was there for 3 years. And 39, it says, "And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead." So David mourns Amnon, and then he's comforted, but he longs for Absalom. And this is interesting. He doesn't do anything about it. He didn't go down and try to bring him back. He doesn't, you know. And I'm sure this has put David in a difficult situation, because now his firstborn, who should have been heir to the throne, he's been killed. And the next in line is Absalom, who has done the murder, right? So how can he be the next? Is that the kind of guy we want as the next king? So David's probably thinking, man, this is a mess. What in the world are we going to do? But nevertheless, he yearns for Absalom. And y'all, I hate to tell you, but this just shows David was an inept father, right? He does not handle any of these situations well, and that's what leads to all the chaos that comes later, even to the dividing of the kingdom that comes at the death of Solomon, and we'll see some of that a little bit later. Joab, who is David's nephew, right? He's the commander of David's armies. Chapter 14, it says, now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. Now, remember, Zeruiah is David's sister. Joab is, of course, her son, so that's David's nephew. Again, man, it is so hard to remember who all is related to who in all this. But Joab gets a woman from Tekoa, and he comes up with this plan to trick David into bringing Absalom back to Jerusalem. So, again, I just think, David, why don't you just go down and talk to that boy? All you got to do is go down and talk to him, right? Or call him back and talk to him, whatever. But no, he's got to be tricked into it. So now this woman from Tekoa, who is a wise woman, Joab comes up with this plan. He says, now listen, I want you to go in before David, and we're going to come up with this story that you're going to tell him. You're going to get him to pass judgment on it. And then at the end of the story, you're going to come back around and tell him, I'm actually talking about you. Now, does that sound familiar? Right. Same thing Nathan, the Lord had instructed Nathan to do over the sin of Bathsheba. So here, a very similar setup, but this is with this wise woman from Tekoa. And so she comes in and she gives him this story. Look at verse 4, and let's just read a little bit of this woman's story so you get an idea of what's going on. Verse 4 says, now the woman of Tekoa came to the king, and she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, save me, O king. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? And she said, alas, I'm a widow. My husband is dead, and your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. And there was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. Now, stop right there for just a minute. Does that story sound familiar? Two brothers in the field, one strikes the other and kills him. Cain and Abel, right? Which I'm sure David is thinking, oh, that sounds like Cain and Abel, right? We know that David knows the Torah, right? So he's probably thinking, oh, well, that sounds interesting here. Verse 7, she says, now the whole clan has arisen against your servant, and they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Now, again, now notice this setup. We got another no-win situation, or a very difficult one according to the Torah, right? Because the just lawful thing to do would be to follow the Torah and put the other son to death. He's committed murder, which is a capital offense under the Mosaic law, which requires the death of that son, right? But the wife is arguing, yeah, that's what my whole clan wants to do. But if they do that, it will destroy my only offspring and the offspring of my husband, and our line will be cut off. So is it really the best thing? And by the way, the Torah really doesn't address that, right? So what do we do here, right? And by the way, the Torah does require, though, that if someone is cut off from the line of the family and you've got one left, then the inheritance goes to him, and you got to do whatever you can to ensure that those things get passed along, right? So again, you got this weird situation. Should he be put to death, or could he be spared, right? David, you're wise, right? As y'all are reading through, notice how many people say to David, you are like the angel of the Lord, whenever they're coming before him for wisdom, right? David, you're just like a messenger from the Lord himself, right? You know what to do. And so verse 8, David gives his judgment. By the way, how do you think he's going to answer this after his episode with Uriah the Hittite? He killed him, offense worthy of death. And what did the Lord do with him? He spared him, right? He didn't hold his sin against him. So verse 8, King David said to the woman, go to your house, I'll give orders concerning you. So the woman said, on me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house. Let the king and his throne be guiltless. So she thinks, so she paints it up like, okay, he's going to have the son killed, right? And so she says, no, let that fall on me. Don't put it out. So verse 10, it says, David said, if anyone says anything to you, bring him to me and he shall never touch you again. And she said, please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more and my son not be destroyed. And David says, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your head's hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Right? So here, David shows mercy, right? Shows mercy even in this case where the Torah mandated the death penalty, right? So with this episode here and with the episode with David, right, we get this thread that runs through the Old Testament. Mercy is oftentimes greater than the law. The mercy and grace of the Lord often, right, stands above even the law itself. And all of us can say amen to that. Right? Because if that were not absolutely true, we would all be in a whole heap of trouble. Because we are only saved by the mercy and the grace of the Lord God. We have offended him in every way we could possibly think of, in ways worthy of death, some not. Right? But nevertheless, it's his mercy and his grace that overrides. So these stories are just absolutely powerful illustrations of that. So then she goes on and says, well, my lord, the king, if you'll let me speak a little bit further, let me apply that to you then, right? why do you keep your banished son away from your home? Right? Look at verse 14. I love what she says here. Very poetic. Dark, but very poetic. Verse 14, she says, we must all die. We are like water spilled out on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Right? In other words, yeah, we've all got to die, but it doesn't have to be today. Right? The Lord can restore, right? The Lord can bring somebody back, and he can definitely bring back your banished son. And then verse 17, she says, listen, the word of my Lord the King will set me at rest, for my Lord the King is like the angel of God, there it is, to discern good and evil. The Lord Yahweh, your God, be with you. In verse 18, David says to her, do not hide from me anything I ask you. And the woman said, let the Lord my King speak. The king said, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? Right? David is wise, right? He's sharp. That sounds like something Joab would come up with. So David listens to him. David listens to the woman. He listens to the advice that's being, you know, subtly given to him here. Notice again at the end of verse 20, Joab. I'm sorry, the woman says again, but my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know how things are to be done on the earth. And so David says to Joab, go, bring back Absalom. And he says, you know, to the woman, you found favor in my sight. Bring him back. But this is the thing, verse 24. David brings Absalom back, but he says, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. Are you kidding me? Right. So what's that going to communicate? Right. You're not the next one, Absalom. You know, okay, I'm going to bring you back, but only so far. Man, I tell you what. One of the great threads in this whole Davidic line story is these men who are so wise can act like the biggest idiots at some of the critical junctures in your life, right? Solomon asked the Lord for wisdom. You remember how wise he is? And by the end of his life, he's one of the biggest fools in the Old Testament. Right? Absolutely incredible the way that works. And this whole intervening story could have been... the way I think about it is, the next five chapters we're going to be in would not be necessary if David had just brought Absalom home and give him a little hug. Right? And restored him back to the palace. Right? All that would have been over with, probably. But he doesn't do that. He makes Absalom set apart to his own. Verse 14:25, it says, "Now in all Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom, taken after the other handsome men." Right? Remember the last person that was described as handsome above all the rest? Saul, right? Whew, man, sometimes good looks get you in all kind of trouble, apparently. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. When he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was very heavy on him, he would cut it, and the hair of his hair weighed 200 shekels by the king's weight. Y'all know how much that is, right? Bottom of page 64, there's a note about that. That's about 5 pounds. That is a lot of hair. You know? That is a lot of hair. So here, also in that note, the mention of Absalom's hair all throughout this call to mind the other tragic stories related to hair. Samson, right, and his hair. Also Esau, who was a very hairy man, if you remember that, and the stealing of the blessing and everything here. So Absalom is returned, and he has been out of shape that, you know, he's in his house on his own. Verse 28, it says, Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence, coming before the king's face. So Absalom sends to Joab, and he says, Joab wouldn't come at first, and then Absalom sets his neighbor's field on fire that belongs to Joab, so Joab has to come see him. And so Absalom says, why did he bring me back only to have me to live apart? It would have been better if I would have stayed in Geshur. And Joab, verse 33, he says, in fact, take me before the king and let him put me to death. It'd be better than living in this exile right here in Jerusalem in his presence. So verse 33, Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. And so he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. But I think it's already too little too late. Right? The damage has already been done, as it's very clear from the next chapter. So, you know, David not handling this first episode with Absalom well, it's going to get into the next 2 chapters where Absalom is going to turn in defiance against David to try to overtake the throne. Now, any questions about any of that section there? Any of that? Let me see if there's anything. Yeah, okay. I touched on most of the notes there that I've got on page 64 related to that. Anybody have any questions or comments on any of that?
What was a big difference between David and Saul? I mean, God preferred one of the...
Saul always referred to the Lord... with Samuel as what? The Lord.
Your God. Yeah. Yeah.
The Lord was never Saul's God.
Yeah, in a sense. Yeah, absolutely.
He kept referring to him as Yahweh, your God.
Yes.
Whereas David did not.
Yeah.
The Lord was his God.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that was a big deal of why accepted David in spite of the terrible failure.
Yes, yeah.
Because and all the tenor of his whole life was just, I don't know that he was an idolater.
Well, and if you think about all the times that Saul rejected the word of the Lord. I think in every instance where the Lord gave Saul something to do, he did not do it, at least in all the recorded ones, right? In 1 Kings 15, let me just read that to you because it's a direct answer to your question, Sandra. 1 Kings 15:5, this is during the reign of Jeroboam. So, you know, we're many years later at this point. And so it says about him, verse 3, it says, now this is talking about Jeroboam, it says, and he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord Yahweh his God as the heart of his father David. Right. So, yeah, so tying into what Tom's saying here, I don't think Saul's heart was ever turned to the Lord, right? David's was, right? And the righteous kings after him. And then it goes on to say this. Now, listen to this. It says, nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem, talking about Jeroboam there. Verse 5, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Doesn't mention Bathsheba, mentions Uriah.
Her name is always the wife.
It's the wife of Uriah. Yeah, absolutely. So here, I think that gives us an indication, you know, tying in what Tom is saying, that Saul's heart was never turned to the Lord fully, right? And especially after the Lord had cut him off, I think Saul began to see the Lord as an adversary. He makes statements like that, you know, several times. But David always did what the Lord told him to do. David also always sought the counsel of the Lord, right? Before he did anything, he would inquire of the Lord, should we do this, should we do that? So, you know, David was always turned toward the Lord, whereas Saul was, I don't think his heart was ever turned toward him. Yeah, and there's some more things in that, but I think that's at the core of what was going on. That's a great question. And again, you know, when you set that in the context of David does sins that are more heinous than Saul does, and yet he's beloved of the Lord. Right? This is now, y'all don't write this down, because this may be heretical theology, right? But I am really a firm believer that you can do all kind of things that are offensive to the Lord, but if you do the major things that are right, it overshadows all those other things. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
God always wants to forgive people.
Yes.
As the Father.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If He is your God, I mean, what did Martin Luther said,
yeah,
love God and do as you please.
That's right. Yeah. Because if you love God, you're going to be headed in the right direction.
Correct.
Right? Doing the right kind of things. And that's what, one of the things that is said about Jesus in the Gospel of John is that he always did what was pleasing to the Father. Right? That's a really powerful statement, right? Because that's what we're called to do, right? We're supposed to have a mind of, Lord, I want to be pleasing to you in all the things that I can possibly do. Are we going to sin while we're doing that? Absolutely. But if the motivation, right? And by the way, okay, I'm going to get real big trouble. I can prove this one. I can prove this one. The Lord is far more interested in the motivations of why we do things rather than the things in and of themselves. Right? Paul says that very thing in 1 Corinthians, where he says that, you know, we're, to paraphrase, you know, we're all going to give an account before the Lord. So let's not pass judgment before the time. Paul says, I can't think of anything against myself, but I'm not acquitted by that. The Lord is the judge. So let's just wait until we stand before him. He's going to bring all things that are in darkness to light. And then it's at that point that he will judge the motives of men's hearts. And then we will receive our commendation, right? Right. The motives, right? David does a lot of bad things, but his primary motive is to always be pleasing to the Lord, right? Does that make sense? You know, man after God's own heart, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That means.
Yeah. He thinks like the Lord thinks, you know, his mindset is shaped by the way the Lord thinks about things. Y'all know that verse in, very powerful. I think it's in 1 Corinthians 2. It's where Paul's making the distinction between the natural person and the person of the Spirit, right? And he says, listen, he goes into the whole thing. The natural man can't accept the things of God, right? Because they're spiritually discerned. So without the Spirit, you can't discern those things. And at the very end of that, he says, but we're not like that because we have the mind of Christ. Right? We have the mind of Christ. The Holy Spirit gives us access to the mind of Christ so that we can think and act and do the things that he does, right? That's what David is doing here, right? Because the mind in the New Testament is somewhat equivalent to the heart in the Old Testament, right? The Greeks didn't think about it exact same way, so when they thought about our motivations and all, they would often attach it to the mind part of things, right? So both of those are the same thing. We think like the Lord God thinks. His thoughts become our thoughts, right? We process things the same way that he does. Now, did we do that perfectly? No, David's a great example of this, right? And that's what I was talking to Dorothy right before class. We were just talking about the chaos in this. We're like, this is so encouraging, right? David's just a man. He's just like all the rest of us, right? And yet he's beloved by God, right? Such a great encouragement. Even with all the mess he makes, he's still headed in the right direction. Y'all follow me? It's still aimed in the right way. Now, let's just talk about, we've got about 5 minutes. Let's talk about this Absalom conspiracy just for a minute. Because a lot of this, I'm just going to summarize. Chapter 15, we get to Absalom. And it says, now after this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. So in other words, he's putting on a really good show. And then we find out, verse 2 down through verse 6, that Absalom would go out before the gate of Jerusalem. And when people would come up to get a judgment from King David, he would say, hey, where are you from? And they would tell him. And he would say, well, what are you here to talk about? And Absalom would butter him up. Oh, yeah, man, your claims are good and right. Man, if I were a judge in Israel, right, if my father would just give me a little say in what's going on, I could take care of these things, and I could help him with some of these disputes, right? And he would, as they would come up, he would bow down, pay homage to him. He'd kiss the hand, right? And so verse 6, it says, so Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment, and Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel, right? He's crafty, just like his daddy, right? Man, he knows how to work the crowd. Here, though, it's a very negative thing. Right. Verse 7, it says, now at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. And so the Lord allows him to go down to Hebron. And while he's there, verse 10, it says, Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. So he sets up this whole thing. To bring Israel, the other tribes of Israel, to himself. And so with Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they were in their innocence, and they knew nothing. And while Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. So there it is. Absalom draws the heart of Israel away from David over to his side. Top of page 65 in your notes. We'll end with this. Next week we'll pick up in verse 13, and David is going to have to flee Jerusalem. He's going to have to get out of there because he realizes if he stays, there's going to be a big confrontation and a lot of people are going to be killed. But on page 65, 15:1, Absalom is the first mention in this section that acquires chariots. Samuel had even predicted that in reference to the king to come, 1 Samuel 8:11. Chariots, and this is really interesting. Up until this point, the only forces that had chariots were the enemies of Israel, the Egyptians, the Canaanites, and the Arameans. All of them brought chariots against Israel, which in ancient warfare, if you were going against an armored force that had chariots, it was very unlikely that you would win if you didn't have some way to counter those chariots. They were very effective in warfare. And so Absalom is one of the first that has these. But the interesting thing is that every time the enemies of Israel used chariots in battle against Israel, they were always defeated and unsuccessful. So there's this little hint that Absalom may think he's somebody riding around in his chariots with his men going in front of him, but this may not turn out the way he thinks it's going to turn out, right? Again, his cunning humility, 15 through 6, just like his father, very shrewd, very crafty. Hebron, he goes there because, of course, it's one of the key religious cities. That's where David had begun his rule, if you remember, for 7 years. So that was the place where Absalom was born, based in 2 Samuel. We read that earlier. And then 1511, Absalom brings with him 200 men from Jerusalem. Most likely, those, based on what we read after this, those would have been men who would have given counsel to David in this dangerous time. And he definitely gets one of the key men, Ahithophel, right? He brings him over. And I'll just remind you who Ahithophel is. That is Bathsheba's grandfather. So Ahithophel, one of David's wisest counselors, he's going to turn on him. And you can't help but think, that's what that whole thing with his granddaughter, right? Because y'all remember, these men hold a vengeance, right? Men, they hold a grudge for a long time and just wait for the right moment. You know, and you read forward into Kings and Chronicles and how many, you know, these guys come on and you got a brothers killing brothers and sons killing fathers, killing people in their sleep to take over the throne. I mean, it's unbelievable kind of treachery that goes on. So here, Ahithophel turns on David, and that would technically be a really bad thing. But as we're going to see next week, it does not turn out the way they think it's going to turn out. So for next week, y'all read, start 15:13, read on through, go on and read on through chapter 18. Go on and read through chapter 18. We'll cover that section to see how Absalom's rebellion turns out. So if you read all through those chapters, you'll be in a good place. And I think, we should be able to get through all those chapters without any problem. There's not a lot that's difficult to understand there, but some really important things happen. Now, any questions or comments on any of that as we close out?